Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. If you saw a mysterious bright light over San Diego's skies on Saturday, you weren't alone, and we'll have details on the source. Also hear about a lawsuit seeking to stop a nuclear waste dump at San Onofre, and about President Obama's decision to block the Keystone XL pipeline. From Sacramento, we'll have updates on the battle over the death penalty, as well as info on a proposed ballot initiative that would end private utilities such as San Diego Gas and Electric and create a statewide public utility instead. The City of San Diego has approved solar panels on more public buildings. And across San Diego County, keep an eye out this week for firefighters and their annual Fill the Boot campaign to help people with muscular dystrophy. Human remains have been found by hikers over the weekend in a remote East County canyon. Also on today's show, hear the outcome of the Aztec hockey team's game on Friday night. If you're a veteran or serve in our military, the State Park Service is offering you free admission to most state parks on Veterans Day, including some beautiful places in our region, and we'll have the list on today's show. Local law enforcement officers are putting out an all-points bulletin for teddy bears to comfort kids in the hospital this holiday season, and we'll tell you how you can help. The Salton Sea is an environmental disaster in the making, but some relief has arrived with a restoration project to restore a portion of the lake's wetlands beginning this week. We'll have details, and today we'll also be replaying our interview with Bruce Wilcox, who is heading up an ambitious plan to restore the Salton Sea and also tap its vast geothermal energy resources. We'll have news about a group of students in Casa de Oro that is working to end blight in their neighborhood. Finally, from Public News Service, we'll have top national stories, including a million student march coming up this week, concerns over liquid natural gas facilities and water, and one state's efforts to outreach to help women veterans. So stay tuned for the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, where East County matters. People across Southern California were startled Saturday night by a bright blue light streaking through the sky with an explosive burst and a vapor trail. There were many sightings reported right here in San Diego. Videos posted on YouTube and Twitter revealed the sight created fear in some, with one viewer speculating this could be the end as the object hurtled closer. Others thought the celestial sight was a UFO or a meteor, since the torrid meteor shower is slated to be visible in early to mid-November. But according to the San Diego Union-Tribune, the U.S. Navy has confirmed that the object was in fact a Trident II D-5 missile being tested offshore. While the Navy does not announce missile tests ahead of time, it did ask for airspace offshore to be cleared near Los Angeles International Airport Saturday night and for 5 nights thereafter, with flights diverted, the Los Angeles Times reported. Trident II missiles launch off of submarines and were designed to carry nuclear warheads, though the test missile was not armed. An armed Trident is capable of traveling up to 7,500 miles, the BBC has reported, and is officially intended to deter a first strike against the U.S. The Navy claims that 155 successful launches of the Trident II D-5, built by Lockheed Martin, have been conducted as of February. There have also been some spectacular failed launches of Trident missiles spiraling into crashes at sea. Sightings of Saturday night's launch were reported as far away as Arizona, Nevada, and San Francisco. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Seeking to prevent construction of what plaintiffs call the most irresponsible nuclear dump ever, attorneys at Aguirre and Severson had filed an action in Superior Court on behalf of Citizens Oversight. The suit asked the Coastal Commission to revoke its approval last week for a nuclear waste dump at San Onofre, located just 100 feet from a state beach park in North San Diego County, in a densely populated area where 8.5 million people live within the 50-mile evacuation zone. The nuclear wastes will remain toxic for thousands of years, yet the casks holding those wastes are only guaranteed 10 years by the manufacturer. And yet the Nuclear Regulatory Commission authorized them for 20 years, with no plan to remove the waste even then. Salt water could cause the casks to degrade even faster, yet at nearly a 500,000 pounds apiece, a degraded cask would be nearly impossible to move safely, the attorneys contend. Attorney Mike Aguirre called the Coastal Commission's unanimous vote an outrageous departure from its chartered responsibilities and the California Coastal Act, adding, "We want the court to revoke Southern California Edison's permit to pollute and force Edison to find a safer location." The attorneys further contend that Edison lobbied coastal commissioners prior to the vote and offered commissioners indemnification for approving the nuclear waste dump, an action Aguirre contends is illegal. The suit also alleges that Edison failed to seriously examine alternate locations to San Onofre, which is in a tsunami and earthquake zone and near Interstate 5 and a major railway line. Ray Lutz, founder of Citizens Oversight, issued this statement. "With this plan having run for decades, Edison now has 3.6 million pounds of spent fuel that will be dangerous for thousands of years, essentially forever. There is no way to snap our fingers and make it disappear. We need to do our best job to find a safe place for the fuel." Lutz noted that all members of the public who testified before the Coastal Commission opposed the dump site of San Onofre. Supervisor Diane Jacobs also sent a letter in opposition. No members of the public testified in support. Southern California Edison claims that the dry cask storage near the public park is safe and secure. But despite Edison's assurances, many San Diego residents have serious concerns over the future safety of our region. Aguirre concludes, "It's time to dump the dump. It isn't safe, it isn't smart, and it places every Southern California resident under a nuclear sword of Damocles." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Bill Driscoll.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. On Friday, President Barack Obama announced that after 6 years of review, the U.S. State Department has decided that the Keystone XL pipeline would not serve the national interest of the United States. President Obama stated, "I agree with that decision." He then laid out key reasons why his administration has rejected the pipeline. First, he indicated the pipeline would not make a meaningful long-term contribution to our economy. The president said what we should be doing is passing a bipartisan infrastructure plan that in the short term would create more than 30 times as many jobs per year as the pipeline would, and in the long run would benefit our economy and our workers for decades to come. Second, Obama stated, the pipeline would not lower gas prices for American consumers. Gas prices are already down a dollar over 2 years ago, and in 41 states, gas is under $2 a gallon at some stations. Third, the president indicated, shipping dirtier crude oil into our country from Canada would not increase America's energy security. What has increased America's energy security is our strategy over the past several years to reduce our reliance on dirty fossil fuels from unstable parts of the world, he said. Obama set a goal to cut oil imports in half by 2020 and met that goal this year, 5 years early. His administration also set a goal to double gas mileage of cars by 2025 and has tripled power from wind and increased solar power 20-fold. Obama noted, America has cut our total carbon pollution more than any other country on Earth. Republicans blasted the president's decision. The Republican Party has claimed that the pipeline would create up to 42,000 jobs. But USA Today newspaper reports that nearly all of those jobs would have been temporary or supplier jobs. Once built, the pipeline was expected to employ less than 50 people. Yet Florida Governor Jeb Bush, a Republican presidential candidate, stated the Obama administration's politically motivated rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline is a self-inflicted attack on the U.S. economy and jobs. Terry O'Sullivan, the president of the Laborers International Union of North America, faulted Obama for, quote, kowtowing to green-collar elitists instead of creating blue-collar jobs for pipeline workers. But 350.org, an organization dedicated to reversing climate change, hailed the decision. In an email to supporters, the environmental group stated, President Obama's courage today is a reflection of the courage shown by thousands of people who have sat in, marched, organized, and opened a lot of emails across North America against this pipeline. The battle to halt the pipeline began in Canada with First Nations, tribes of Native people opposed to extraction of dirty tar sands that would impact their lands. Later, farmers, ranchers, and tribal nations all along the pipeline route joined the protest, along with environmentalists and others. 350.org accuses the oil industry of increasingly reckless actions, such as fracking during California's drought, using and contaminating millions of gallons of water, creating huge coal pits in Appalachia, and seeking to pump tar sands from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. A 350.org letter concludes, "When world leaders meet in Paris later this year, they'll do so knowing what our movement can do and what climate action really looks like, keeping fossil fuels in the ground." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
California has not executed a prisoner since 2006 due to legal challenges. Although there are 747 inmates on death row, and at least 17 of those have exhausted all appeals, the Sacramento Bee reports. But executions may soon resume if a proposal by the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation is approved. The plan calls for use of a single drug to execute condemned prisoners instead of a multiple drug mixture previously used. The drug of choice for executions could actually be one of the four barbiturates specified in the proposal. The announcement has drawn both support and opposition. Sacramento defense attorney Don Heller, who has fought to abolish the death penalty, has stated, "The system is broken, and society will be a lot better without capital punishment because it just doesn't work." He also cited the high cost of executions as a reason for ending capital punishment. But Ken Schoenberger at the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation called the action a victory, particularly for families of murder victims who have been waiting for justice. A settlement required creation of a new lethal injection that would withstand court challenges and that would not violate the Constitution's prohibition of cruel or unusual punishment. 30 states and the federal government now rely on lethal injections as the preferred means of execution. But some drug makers have balked at supplying the pharmaceuticals for lethal injection, making supply an issue and causing some states to experiment with drug mixtures, in some cases with disturbing results, where death was far from swift or painless. Californians' views on capital punishment are mixed, with slightly over half, 54%, supporting it in the latest field poll, while 34% opposed the death penalty. The public has 75 days to comment on the proposal, which can be read in full at the Corrections Department website. In addition, a public hearing will be held on January 22nd. But voters may have the ultimate say. Former MASH TV star Mike Farrell has launched a proposed ballot measure that would eliminate the death penalty in California. Meanwhile, a competing measure, backed by law enforcement and victims' rights groups, seeks to speed up executions and force condemned prisoners to pay restitution to victims' families. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Bill Driscoll.
California's Secretary of State has approved signature gathering for a ballot initiative that, if approved by voters, would end private utility corporations such as San Diego Gas and Electric, Southern California Edison, and Pacific Gas and Electric Company. Under the measure, the state would buy out these companies and operate a publicly owned California electrical utility district that would set electricity rates, build infrastructure, and provide power. The measure's backer, Ben Davis Jr., contends the state can provide power at lower rates for California customers and notes that nationwide, public utilities have 15% lower rates on average than privately owned utilities. The Sacramento Municipal Utility District, or SMUD, a public district where Davis served as rate advisory board member, averages 25% lower rates than California's investor-owned utilities. The initiative would allow existing public utility districts such as SMUD to remain. It's unclear, however, whether it would allow formation of new municipally owned districts, such as the San Diego Energy Foundation's proposal for a public district to serve the San Diego region. An 11-member elected board, with each member representing a ward or district, would run the new state utility district. How successful or not a publicly owned utility district could be might hinge on who serves on that board, since the caliber of governance is always key. The recent scandals and at times failure to provide oversight by the Public Utilities Commission in California is an example of failed governance. But a key difference is that the PUC commissioners are appointed by the governor, whereas board members for the new California Electrical Utility District would be elected by the people and presumably could be removed by the people if they abused their powers. Utility corporations are expected to wage a vigorous campaign to oppose the measure if it qualifies for the ballot. Two prior efforts by Davis to create a public utility district failed to get enough signatures, but recent utility scandals and investigations into alleged undue influence by utilities on the Public Utilities Commission over the San Bruno pipeline explosion and other matters could spur more consumer interest in doing away with investor-owned utilities. Voters might perceive publicly owned utilities as offering greater transparency, with profits flowing to the public treasury instead of corporate shareholders. Elimination of private utility corporations could have sweeping implications, potentially impacting everything from grid stability to wildfire detection and firefighting services provided by utilities, as well as an end to grants that private utilities give many local charities. If enacted, the measure would also eliminate the utility industry's powerful lobbying force that has pushed to slash incentives for consumers to invest in rooftop solar, back the nuclear waste dump at San Onofre, and lobby to provide incentives for building industrial-scale power facilities, such as desert solar and massive wind projects, as well as high-voltage lines, such as Sunrise PowerLink. Backers have until April 26, 2016, to gather the 365,880 signatures needed to qualify for the ballot. But under new election laws, if Davis succeeds in getting at least 25% of the required ballot signatures, California's Senate and Assembly committees would be required to hold hearings on the proposal, UtilityDive.com reports. Davis is also pushing for a second initiative that would shut down California's last remaining nuclear power plant, Diablo Canyon. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
A plan for installing solar panels for 25 San Diego properties over the next two decades has been unanimously approved Tuesday by the San Diego City Council. The sites will be for 9 rooftop solar systems and 19 parking lot systems. The locations that are being used are 7 police stations, 4 libraries, the city administration building, and the structures around it, the parking lot for Mission Trails Regional Park, and Balboa's Inspiration Point. According to KPPS, Sun Government Solutions LLC would install, operate, own, and maintain the solar photovoltaic systems over the next 20 years. The city would be purchasing the power supplied by the systems for Sun Edison, replacing electricity that would have been supplied by San Diego Gas and Electric. According to the Times of San Diego, city officials estimated that the cost of purchasing power for these 25 facilities from SDG&E to be $48 million over the next two decades, versus $26 million for solar from Sun Edison. Going through with this would save $22 million with a range of $500,000 in the first year of operation to slightly more than $1.7 million annually by the end of the term, according to the staff report. Committee Chairman Mark Kersey said at an earlier hearing on the proposal that the savings projections are fairly conservative, with costs of traditional energy sources expected to increase in the future. Mario Sierra, director of the city's Environmental Services Department, said construction could begin approximately March or April next year and may be finished by August. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is DeVario Bell.
Firefighters from CAL FIRE, along with the Muscular Dystrophy Association, will celebrate their 61-year partnership by kicking off the Firefighters' annual Fill the Boot fundraising campaign this week to benefit children and adults affected by the life-threatening muscle disease throughout the San Diego area. More than 300 members of CAL FIRE will fan out across San Diego County with boots in hand for this year's drive, November 9th through 13th at intersections across the county. Firefighters in the San Diego area do more for Muscular Dystrophy Association and the families they serve than any other group, dedicating countless hours of their time every year to participating in Fill the Boot drives and at MDA's summer camp. In the last 2 years, CAL FIRE firefighters collected over $50,000 for MDA, filling the boot at San Diego intersections. Cal Fire is the number one firefighting contributor to MDA in California and the second largest in the nation. This year, after consolidating with County Fire Service and rural agencies across San Diego County, they're hoping to do even better. The aptly named Captain Angel Hendry, chairperson of CAL FIRE's San Diego Fill the Boot campaign, says our goal for 2015, our 61st anniversary with MDA, is to have 100% participation from all CAL FIRE stations. Funds raised through 2015 will help support MDA's programs of worldwide research, specialized healthcare services, and day-to-day support, which includes sending children affected by muscular dystrophy and related diseases to a week-long, barrier-free MDA summer camp at Camp Cuyamaca, and that's right here in Descanso, where KNSJ broadcasts from. As the Muscular Dystrophy Association's largest national sponsor, the International Association of Firefighters fuels the mission to find treatments and cures for life-threatening muscle diseases. In 2014, last year, more than 100,000 firefighters nationwide participated in Fill the Boot events across the United States, and they raised $21.4 million. To date, firefighters have raised over $500 million for the Muscular Dystrophy Association. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
Hikers in the Hapachul Valley area found human remains Sunday morning. Deputies from the Pine Valley substation responded at 9:30 a.m. to a call on Hapachul Valley Road and confirmed the grisly finding in nearby canyon. The sheriff's homicide detail is investigating, said Lieutenant Ken Nelson. A positive identity of the victim, as well as the cause and manner of death, are pending an autopsy by the medical examiner's office. Anybody with information is asked to call the homicide detail at 858-974-2321, or you can remain anonymous and call Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477 and be eligible for a reward of up to $1,000 for information leading to an arrest in this case.
This is Liz Alburn with a sports report for East County Magazine on KNSJ. Santa Rosa Junior College visited the Croc Center on Friday night, and the Aztecs showed the Northern California College what San Diego hockey is all about. Christian Garrett got the ball rolling 6 minutes into the first period with a slapper from the point on the power play to give the Aztecs a 1-0 lead. For the Aztecs, Friday was all about the power play. They had 4 power plays in the first period. Sophomore Hayden Bowles scored midway through the first on another power play goal, giving the Aztecs a 2-0 lead in the first frame. In the second period, Bowles scored his 2nd goal of the night, a controversial play to make it 3-0 Aztecs. 30 seconds later, Alec Kristoff went 5-hole for a 4-0 SDSU lead. The Aztecs weren't done yet. In the span of 2.5 minutes, they scored 4 goals, giving SDSU a 6-0 lead. Travis Sevilla and Vincent DiMaggio both added the last 2 goals. In the third period, goaltender Connor O'Brien lost his shutout opportunity as the Bears narrowed the deficit to 5 when Matt Brownlee slipped one in 5-hole, 6-1 Aztecs. That's all the visitors would manage as SDSU earns their 7th win of the season. DiMaggio had 5 points, a goal, and 3 assists.
If you're a veteran, active duty, or reserve military member, you can visit many state parks free on Veterans Day, which is Wednesday, November 11th. In San Diego, state parks offering free admission include Cuyamaca Rancho State Park, Palomar Mountain State Park, and several state beaches, including Cardiff, Carlsbad, San Alejo, San Onofre, Silver Strand, South Carlsbad, and Torrey Pines. Statewide, 134 parks are participating, as well as the California State Railroad Museum and 8 state vehicular recreation areas. Veterans, active duty, and reserve military personnel must show a valid military ID at the park in order to receive free admission. The state's Department of Parks and Recreation also has a free Distinguished Veteran Pass for honorably discharged war veterans who are residents of California, as well as prisoners of war or recipients of the Medal of Honor. To get more information, you can visit the Department of Parks and Recreation website.
The San Diego Regional Law Enforcement Teddy Bear Drive is putting out an all-points bulletin on new stuffed teddy bears with tags still attached. They are asking the public to turn them in at any law enforcement station or at Chick-fil-A restaurants in San Diego County. The teddy bears will be donated and delivered on December 8th to Rady Children's Hospital to comfort sick and scared children. The teddy bear drive was started by Coronado Police Officer Brian Hardy back in 1990, who says, "This is for all the kids." That first year, Hardy happened upon an empty toy donation bin at Rady Children's Hospital, so he loaded up his patrol car on his own time and brought in a dozen bears to donate in the name of the Coronado Police Department. Since that time, the drive has grown to include every law enforcement agency in the San Diego region joining in. About 60,000 stuffed animals are now collected each year. Cash donations also allow teddy bear drive coordinators to replenish the supply of stuffed animals when those run out, so that every child admitted to the hospital year-round receives a stuffed animal. Money is also donated towards special keepsake memory boxes and comfort bears for the parents of children who pass away while a patient at Rady Children's. While the Teddy Bear Drive has various generous business and community group supporters, the bulk of the donations still come from law enforcement. Even though Hardy is retiring at the end of December, he said he feels like the drive is part of him and he will continue to serve on the planning committee and donate. Another intent of the teddy bear collection is to let officers who often witness children in traumatic situations do something positive for children. In several instances, the drive has also touched some officers personally when their own child or family member was sick. In the eighth year of the teddy bear drive, and the day before officers delivered the bears to the hospital, Hardy's own 2-year-old daughter became critically ill from a ruptured appendix. He didn't tell anyone his daughter was a patient, but the word got out and she was given a teddy bear. After she was released, Hardy doubled his efforts to collect more stuffed animals for the hospital. All law enforcement officers and the court's probation department now participate in the drive, collecting new stuffed animals or monetary donations. Rady Children's Hospital also accepts toys and donations to bring smiles to the young patients year-round. For more information, visit teddybeardrive.com.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ. The Salton Sea, which smells like rotten eggs due to massive contamination and evaporation, is an ecological disaster poised to get even worse in 3 years when the water flowing into the lake from the Colorado River is scheduled to be shut off. But this week, the tide began to turn. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is beginning the first restoration project at the Salton Sea along Red Hill Bay on the southern shore. That project will flood 420 acres of exposed lake bed with water from the nearby Alamo River and the lake itself, creating wetland habitat for migratory birds and also keeping toxic dust out of the air, while still leaving room for energy companies to tap the region's vast geothermal potential. Now, while this project is only a drop in the bucket toward restoring the total lake, it is a start. But big investments will be needed to do more. Today seemed like a good time to replay for you our interview aired back in July with Bruce Wilcox from the Imperial Irrigation District, and he's the manager of Environmental and Salton Sea Programs. Hear why the Salton Sea poses a threat even to us in San Diego County, and learn about the brand new Salton Sea Restoration and Renewable Energy Initiative to save the lake and its rich treasure of natural resources. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. My very special guest today is Bruce Wilcox, Bruce is with the Imperial Irrigation District, and he is the manager of Environmental and Salton Sea Programs. And we're going to be talking about the threats to the Salton Sea today and why that matters here in San Diego County, what can be done. And he's going to be giving us a sneak preview of the brand new Salton Sea Restoration and Renewable Energy Initiative that he's been working on. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about why the Salton Sea is so important and what could happen if it dries up.
Well, the Salton Sea is important for quite a few reasons. One of the biggest reasons is it's probably the most important stopover point on the Pacific Migratory Flyway for birds, and it's one of the last remaining stopover points in Southern California, so it's amazingly important from a wildlife perspective. It's also important from at least two other areas. The economic impact of the Salton Sea drying up or portions of it drying up is huge to the agricultural industry. The Imperial Valley and Yuma and Coachella Valley probably are the largest producer of winter vegetables in the United States. So certainly if we have a lot of dust that damages crops, that's going to mean a big difference to the cost of vegetables all over the United States. And then finally, there's the health concerns. As the playa exposes, there's going to be more and more dust. We have an air quality mitigation program that we're working on, but we still will have dust coming off of the playa, and that's a serious health hazard, both from an asthma perspective, other lung diseases.
Yeah, and that playa is the salty desert crust, and it contains some chemicals from agricultural runoff and other things that we really don't want to be breathing in.
That's exactly right. It has some potential toxics and a lot of salt.
For those not familiar, the Salton Sea is due east of here in Imperial Valley in the Colorado Desert, in Imperial Valley, just next door here. And the lake was once 400 square miles. It's shrunk to about 250 square miles right now. And unless some drastic actions are taken, it could go away entirely. So, Bruce, can you bring our listeners up to speed a little bit on the history of this? How did this lake get started? It is the largest lake in California, and it is currently a saltwater lake. Tell us a little bit about how it got started and how we've gotten to where we are today.
Sure. Over the history, over the geologic history, there have been lakes in the valley. Those lakes have evaporated and formed playas. The Salton Sea Trough is one of those playa areas. In early 1900s, about 1905, when they first started irrigation in the Imperial Valley, one of the gates at the Colorado River broke and caused the Colorado River to discharge into the Imperial Valley for a couple of years, and that filled it up to the 400 square miles you referenced.
So it was a broken canal that caused the lake we now know as the Salton Sea today.
It was. You hear it called an accidental lake a lot, and I guess that's true, but the geological history would suggest that there has been water in that area as it has been dry.
So in the 1940s and 50s, this was really a thriving recreational paradise. It was a haven for boaters and fishermen and kids at play. There were resorts that sprung up. And of course, it was a wonderful wildlife habitat and even still is today, with hundreds of species of birds that are found out there. But then it's begun to dry up, and it isn't just due to the drought. Can you explain some of the factors at play here?
Sure. One of the reasons that the sea is receding is because of the Quantification Settlement Agreement water transfer between the three water agencies, IID, San Diego County Water Authority, and Coachella Valley Water District. That was part of a settlement back in 2003 to get California to live within its 4.4 million acre-feet allocation of Colorado River water. So in essence, that was a drought back in 2003. These were measures to control the drought, just like we're in now.
So as far as the role of San Diego, they were getting water from what, the Colorado River is part of that deal? Is that correct?
Yes, they get 200,000 acre-feet of water from the settlement agreement.
Mm-hmm.
It's not ramped up yet.
And that's water that used to go to the Salton Sea, so they basically were diverting it. And in trade, what is the city of San Diego doing to help protect the Salton Sea?
Well, when the water transfer deal was cut, the three water agencies agreed to pay somewhere in the neighborhood of $370 million for mitigation. That mitigation included things at the Salton Sea, air quality issues, fish issues, habitat issues, and issues in the valley itself.
And that mitigation money runs out in 2017, correct?
The mitigation money probably runs out in about 2023 or 2024. The state of California is contractually obligated to fund the mitigation.
So to be clear, so the mitigation payments from these three water agencies ends in 2017, and the money will actually run out somewhere around 2022, 2023. And then what happens?
Well, the mitigation water stops in at the end of 2017, and that's a mitigation measure. The money for funding mitigation measures that IID implements runs out sometime around 2023, 2024, and then the state of California is contractually obligated to pay the difference or pay the remaining of the mitigation. The reason the mitigation water was delivered to the Salton Sea to start with is because when the QSA was approved by the IID board and others, the state of California had made a legislative promise to restore the Salton Sea, and we assumed by 2017 that would happen. So
the depression or recession came along, and suddenly there wasn't a huge amount of money flowing into or out of the state anymore. So where are we now? I understand that you've told me there are three types of actions being taken to help save the Salton Sea. Can you tell us what those are?
Well, there are a combination of three different kinds of actions, I think. The first is just the mitigation that we're doing now, the delivering of water to the Salton Sea that has kept the salinity trends where they were supposed to be. The real enemy to habitat at the Salton Sea isn't the elevation change. It's the salinity of the water, and we're getting close to that now.
And if it becomes too saline, it doesn't even have to dry out. If it's too saline, we're talking about, you know, hundreds of bird species that could just die out, right? There's no other body of water that they land on during their migratory path out in that vast desert area.
That's correct. It's probably the most critical link on the Pacific Flyway that in Southern California that we know of.
Okay.
And when we get to about 60 parts per thousand, the fish population won't sustain, so the piscivorous birds or the fish-eating birds won't be there anymore. The sea will still have some kind of ecosystem to it, but as it gets saltier and saltier, it'll be more like the Great Salt Lake.
Okay, so there's the short-term mitigation, which includes some air quality elements and so forth. What about number two, which is the Salton Sea Authority restoration, a little bit longer-term restoration proposal?
The Salton Sea Authority is a joint powers authority. IID is a member of this, mm-hmm. of that authority, along with a lot of other folks. And they're putting together what we would call a longer-range restoration plan for the entire Salton Sea. A couple things to keep in mind about that plan. One, it isn't funded yet, and secondly, it's going to have to be a smaller sea.
Yeah, the state, I understand, initially was talking about it would take $9 billion to restore the Salton Sea, and of course, in this economy, that's pretty unrealistic to expect to get out of the legislature. So tell me about what this smaller scale plan would include.
Well, the smaller scale plan that the Salton Sea Authority is working on will include some kind of marine lake or recreational lake of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
It will include habitat around portions of the sea. It will include a center brine sink. Most of the plans include that. And it's coupled with the third leg of the stool, I guess, for Salton Sea restoration, and that is the Salton Sea Restoration and Renewable Energy Initiative.
We'll be talking about that very exciting prospect in a moment. But on the Salton Sea Authority, you've mentioned that it wouldn't take $9 billion that you're talking about. Instead of billions, you're talking about maybe tens of millions over some period of time, and that it could be done incrementally, correct?
I think that's the important part of this, yes. Getting a $9 billion bank fund isn't going to happen. So we need to look at an incremental approach. We can look at $10 million, $50 million a year for the next few years and build as much habitat as we can over that time frame. The other plans had a lot of berms in them across the center of the lake and other places that cost a lot of money up front. This way we can create habitat, deal with air quality issues in an incremental pattern over the next few years as the sea recedes.
Okay, now let's talk about what you've been working on that's going to be released, I understand, in the next couple of weeks. So listeners, this is a sneak preview here of the Salton Sea Restoration and Renewable Energy Initiative. How much renewable energy potential is there in the Salton Sea area?
Well, there could be upwards of 2,000 megawatts of renewable energy, geothermal energy, around the southeast corner of the Salton Sea.
And that's huge. I mean, we're talking about other massive-scale energy projects that don't produce a fraction of that much energy, where we're seeing, you know, vast tracts of desert, millions of acres being bulldozed or proposed for it, for, say, desert solar and wind and so forth. And you could do it in geothermal. How much land use does it require to produce that much geothermal power?
Well, typically a geothermal plant contains a turbine and that's probably a 20 to 25 acre site. It contains 4 to 6 wells, which are 3 to 4 acres each, and it contains the pipelines to connect those wells, and the wells are usually not more than a mile or a mile and a half apart.
So much, much, much smaller impact on the land. Obviously, there's a little bit of light disruption at night and so forth, but nowhere near, it sounds like, the massive environmental damage that we've seen from not only what we see from, say, a oil-based power plant or gas-based power plant, but also huge land use from even some renewables like the desert solar projects, for example.
Yeah, much less of an impact.
Interesting. So tell us some more about this. How important is it to develop this geothermal resource? What does that mean for not only saving the Salton Sea, but also for America?
Well, we think that renewable energy needs to be accelerated in California and across the United States. We have serious issues with the amount of carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere and just basic carbon. Geothermal plants are not completely non-emissive, but they don't have anywhere near the CO2 footprint.
So you think it's important to address the climate change or the CO2 emission problem?
I think it's very important. They're also what we call a base load power, and they don't have to have a backup generation of a natural gas plant or something else that produces even more CO2. And as we've already talked about, they're much more benign to the environment than some of the other.
It's interesting because over the weekend we saw the Public Utilities Commission approve a new energy rate plan that is going to force people to pay more for energy that's consumed during peak power periods like the afternoon. And the reason they gave is because, as we're shifting to renewables, wind produces most of the power at night and solar peaks just before noon. But in that mid-afternoon, we want people to use less. So you're saying that if we got our baseline power from geothermal instead, that would not be a problem?
It would be much less of a problem. There's always some balancing mm-hmm. that has to go on, but it would be much less of a problem.
It would certainly make the grid more stable, too.
It would.
Okay, very important. How compatible is geothermal power with wildlife in your experience?
Well, we have the Salton Sea Sunny Bono National Wildlife Refuge is out amongst the geothermal plants that have built there already. Part of the initiative planning that we've been working on is to develop habitat air quality mitigation that fits in around the geothermal plants. It takes into consideration that there's going to be a geothermal well over on that side and a power plant over on that side and a pipeline that connects the two. And if you can imagine, the type of habitat we're talking about building is a series of berms that would be flooded with water. One of those berms would have to be built for the pipeline. So we've got some synergy between the two projects, less berms that have to be built for the habitat.
Very good. Now, besides geothermal, I also understand that your proposal includes taking a look at something called saline gradient solar. How does that work?
Well, we're kind of excited about that. And this saline gradient solar ponds are essentially an impoundment area of 20 acres with different layers of water in them. And each layer of water has a slightly higher saline content than the one above it. So the lowest layer is almost supersaturated saline. And it's denser because it's heavier. It's got the salt in it, and it stays on the bottom. The sun shines down through the upper layers and heats that bottom layer, and you extract the heat or the energy from that water and spin a turbine and generate electricity. They're almost like a solar battery. You could imagine you could let the sun shine on them all day, pull the power off at night if you needed it, pull the power off in the middle of the day if you needed it. Much less of an impact, we think, than some of the PV solar and some of those other programs. We're in the middle of experimenting with those down at the Salton Sea right now. We think they show a lot of promise.
Fascinating. Does it require very much water, by the way, for either the type of solar you're talking about or for the geothermal, for that matter?
Geothermal uses water, and IID has an industrial allocation of water for geothermal plants.
So that's covered.
That is covered. More geothermal plants, more water, though. I mean, there is a trade-off in all of this.
Yeah.
And the other piece from the saline gradient pond point of view is you could use seawater. You wouldn't have to use irrigation water for those. But one of the things we are looking at is how much do they evaporate because of the
heat. Can they use recycled water?
They could use recycled water. But I think we would probably look at recycled water as a better use for habitat and then after it's used in the habitat, put it in the ponds. We have a finite amount of water to use, and we need to manage that in the ways we can and get multiple uses out of it by either the habitat. Each stage of the habitat will be slightly saltier or more saline, and different kinds of birds and different insects like those areas. And so you continue to use that water and cascade it from one to the next, then discharge it someplace else, and then discharge it to the Salton Sea.
That's all very exciting, Bruce. How optimistic are you that this plan could actually succeed, and what do you view as the chief impediments or potential impediments to it?
I am very optimistic that we will move forward with both a plan like this and a larger-scale restoration program. In the last year and a half, we've made a lot of progress towards that. And the IID board and our general manager have been very supportive. We've got a team of people working on it on our side that have done a lot of good work. I think the biggest impediment, and quite frankly, we don't have a choice. We're going to have to do something. The air quality impacts, if we don't do anything at the Salton Sea, are severe.
Yeah, and we should note that Imperial Valley already has some of the highest asthma rates in the nation. Childhood asthma rates there are staggering, and yet this could make it much, much worse and overflow. That same air would blow into San Diego County here as well as into parts of Arizona. So the potential scale of the harm is huge. I understand there's an economic dollar figure that's been estimated. If the Salton Sea were not restored, what would the economic impact be from all sources?
The Pacific Institute did a study about 6 or 8 months ago that suggested that the cost of not restoring the Salton Sea could be upwards of $70
billion. $70 billion. And that includes what? Lost tourism and agriculture and what else?
Lost tourism, lost property values, health issues, damage to crops. It looks at all the potential economic impacts of not restoring the Salton Sea. $70 billion.
Yeah, and then, of course, loss of hundreds of species of birds, priceless.
Absolutely. That's not, other than from a visitor point of view, that's not calculated into that. And to the point of the birds, we have lost most of the wildlife or the wetland habitat in Southern California and the interior of Southern California. So there isn't really a way to put a cost on losing the Salton Sea from the birds' perspective.
This is critical from a wildlife standpoint. Bruce, where will this report of yours be released? We're talking about the Salton Sea Restoration and Renewable Energy Initiative you're hearing a sneak preview of today. Bruce, where can people find a copy of that, and when will it be posted?
It will be posted sometime in July, and it will certainly be on IID's webpage.
That's the Imperial Irrigation District, and what is the website?
IID.com. And it'll be available there. We're also going to take it to the state of California. We've had some discussions with them already. It'll also be rolled into the Salton Sea Authority's plan.
What can listeners who care about this issue do to help assure that the Salton Sea will be preserved and restored?
Well, we've raised, I think, in the last year or so, the visibility of the Salton Sea has been raised a lot. And I think we need to continue that pressure. Folks need to talk to their congresspeople or their representatives. They need to come to Salton Sea Authority.
State legislators also?
State legislators and federal. The funding is going to have to come from both the state and the federal government.
Okay.
So there has to be a press, and people need to let their legislators know how important this is. We have, especially on our side of the mountain, not as many people to say how important it is. So the more people in Southern California and Arizona that want to either speak to their legislature about the economic or the air quality issues, or that are just lovers of wildlife and birds, need to talk to people and say, this is important to us. We need to have Prop 1 money, for instance, allocated to the Salton Sea. And we need to have a long-range funding program.
Listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with Bruce Wilcox with the Imperial Irrigation District about the future of the Salton Sea. Bruce, I'm going to let you have the last word here. What else would you like our listeners on KNSJ to know that we haven't already mentioned?
I think the thing to do, or the thing that the listeners should know, is that we need to keep the visibility up. We need to move forward with restoration programs. We need to have funding to do that. I think the other thing, though, quite honestly, that we need to do is manage expectations a little bit. It's very difficult to imagine the Salton Sea returning to what it was in the 1950s and 60s. But we can have a recreational lake at the Salton Sea, I think, and we can have habitat at the lake, and we can mitigate the air quality problems at the lake if we just can all get both the state and the federal government pulling in the same direction we are. And we've made a lot of progress in that in the last year, and I'm very confident that we're going to make some more. We've got people in our offices, for instance, that work all the time on this. They're some of the brightest people I've ever met, Jessica Lovecchio, Kelly Bishop, and others. And if they can't solve this problem, nobody can.
Very good. I want to thank you so much, Bruce, for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
Efforts of local teens with the East County Youth Coalition have spurred action with residents and business owners in Casa de Oro. What started as a neighborhood assessment of 12 out of the 19 licensed alcohol businesses on Campo Road by the teenagers has led to questions by community members who want to know why business and property owners are not meeting business standards related to trash, graffiti, loitering, and advertising. The diverse group met for the first time in September, and now they're examining options for improving their community's quality of life. Another meeting is planned for this Thursday, November 12th at 6 p.m. in the Casa de Oro Library in Spring Valley. The area along Campo Road through Casa de Oro in unincorporated San Diego County has been deteriorating through the years, but it took the actions of a few committed high school kids to bring new energy to the issue. The group's forefront concerns were the many new smoke shops, liquor stores, and abandoned buildings, as well as dumping of couches and other debris in the area. Community residents want change. Laura McGrew, who has lived in the neighborhood for 10 years and serves as president of the Parent Teacher Student Association, or PTA, at Spring Valley Middle School, asks, why are we becoming the dumping ground for these types of businesses? McGrew says she is tired of all the new smoke shops and alcohol licenses, adding, we don't understand how it is possible for a hookah lounge to also have an alcohol license. Isn't there an ordinance to limit smoke shops, marijuana dispensaries, and liquor stores by schools? There is in some of the cities out here, such as El Cajon, but not in the unincorporated part of the county. Many voice concern about the types of businesses showing up in the neighborhood and the fact that residents seem to have little or no voice on what types of businesses are setting up shop near their schools and their churches. The initial group of 15 concerned residents has grown since last month. The second meeting on October 8th at the library almost filled the room to capacity with 42 residents who came to learn more about what they can do to help. Resources were brought in by the Institute of Public Strategies, or IPS, which is a community-based organizing agency that helps communities address public health and safety problems that are related to alcohol or drugs that can impact quality of life of residents. IPS also sponsors the East County Youth Coalition that collected the data released at the first meeting. County officials were also present from the San Diego Sheriff's Department, County Planning and Development Services Department, and the San Miguel Fire Department. Steve Murray, supervisor of the San Diego County Code Compliance Team, said it's the owner's responsibility to keep a property in shape. He explained that there's not a lot that 8 code enforcement officers are able to do with 4,300 square miles of county land and 4,000 open cases. In the past, he said, the code compliance team maintained 22 code enforcement officers, not 8. It wasn't clear why the staffing numbers have been slashed. What did become clear was the level of frustration with disgruntled residents who were planning next steps and securing appropriate information to get rid of the blight in their area. One attendee said, this is not the friendly, pleasant place it used to be, and the rest of the room nodded their heads in agreement. Dale Swan from the Casa de Oro Business Association voiced concern over the safety of kids in the community. He said, every night there's a new death because of alcohol. Where's the line that can be drawn so there isn't so much access? Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, November the 9th, 2015. I'm Mike Clifford. Among the stories on a nationwide rundown, college students prepare for a nationwide million student march. At issue, tens of thousands in student debt. Concerns about liquefied natural gas facilities and water issues, plus an update on outreach to women in uniform. Now our top story, students across the nation tired of waiting for leaders to fix what they see as a crisis in higher education. That's why they are calling for a million student march later this week. Eric Galatis has more.
On Thursday, students from over 100 campuses will join a national day of action demanding tuition-free public college, cancellation of all student debt, and a $15 minimum wage for all campus workers. Elon Axelbank, an organizer at Northeastern University in Boston, says continued state budget cuts and rising tuition costs have created an education crisis. He says in the richest nation in the world, students shouldn't have to take on what he calls crippling debt to get a college degree.
So in order for you to get an education, you have to take out loans from these private industries who are profiting off of the fact that we just want to get an education so that we can contribute to society in the best way that we possibly can.
Axelbank says on average, this year's class of college graduates will have to pay back over $35,000 in student loans. He points to U.S. government data showing more than 40 million people share over $1 trillion in debt, and he says 58% of that is held by the poorest 25% of Americans.
The Facebook event page for Texas State University's San Marcos campus invites all comers, and we're told if your campus is not involved yet, there's still time to sign up at studentmarch.org. And speaking of actions, young people expected to take to the streets in the nation's capital today to demand action on race, climate, and immigration. The protest is being called Our Generation, Our Choice. Organizers say groups involved will include United We Dream, Million Hoodies, and 350.org. Earlier this year, Minnesota was ranked the top state for the well-being of children, but a children's advocacy group is touring the state to show there's still work to be done.
According to the Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, the state's child poverty rate rose 3% from 2008 to 2013. Stephanie Hoganson, research and policy director for the Defense Fund, says that problem's being highlighted in the latest Minnesota Kids Count data book, which is also being released this week.
This year's data book really focuses on increasing access to opportunities for children of color and American Indian children. We have many great programs and policies that are implemented across the state, but not all children who are eligible can access them.
Hoganson hopes this year's Kids Count Coffee Tour, which starts Tuesday in Minneapolis, will help communities and lawmakers continue to talk about which programs are working and which are not. I'm Brandon Campbell, reporting.
The 2015 Kids Count Coffee Tour will stop in more than a dozen Minnesota communities through the end of this month. More than 20 environmental and civic groups have delivered a letter to New York Governor Cuomo asking him to veto a liquefied natural gas facility. Andrea Sears says it's called the Port Ambrose Project.
Following 4 days of public hearings last week, the governor has until December 21st to stop the offshore liquefied natural gas facility proposed for 20 miles from Long Island's Jones Beach. Jessica Roth of Catskill Mountain Keeper says the port is unnecessary and hazardous.
It's incredibly dangerous. It's destructive to the ocean floor, to the water, to the air, and then anything that relies on the ocean for its livelihood.
Liberty Natural Gas, the developer of the project, says the port would stabilize the natural gas supply and lower the price in a region that has some of the highest gas prices in the country. The public comment period on Port Ambrose ends on November 30th. Either Governor Cuomo or New Jersey Governor Chris Christie can veto the project.
And sticking with the environment, time running out now for Congress to pass the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. Chris Thomas tells us at the White House Tribal Nations Conference late last week, there were glimmers of hope it could still be possible.
President Obama told the group he's committed to working with tribal nations to protect natural resources and honor their heritage. Kathy Hill with the Klamath Tribes was there and says she heard mixed views about the future of the water agreement.
Sally Jewell was optimistic, but then another person, not with the administration, told me, you know, nothing's going to get through this house this year. And you know, that's the mood, I think, maybe in Washington, D.C.
The agreement covers water use in Southern Oregon and Northern California. It was hammered out by more than 40 parties, but it expires at the end of this year without congressional approval.
And finally, as Veterans Day approaches, a new program for women who have served in the U.S. Armed Forces is gaining attention and support. Greg Steidelmeyer has more from Kentucky.
There are around 22 million veterans in America, and 331,000 of them live in Kentucky, including nearly 25,000 who are women. Kentucky's Department of Veterans Affairs has made increasing outreach to women vets a priority this year. The state's Commissioner of Veterans Affairs, Heather French Henry, says a key focus is helping them transition back into the civilian workforce.
Women veterans have a higher percentage of unemployment rate than their male counterparts.
The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs projects that over the next 30 years, the percentage of veterans who are women will increase from around 10% to around 17%.
That's our news for now. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, royalty-free music. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.